Welcome to the AC Podcast, everyone. This is Terry Crosby.
Andy Steiger.
Steve Kim.
Welcome back, Andy.
Yeah, you know what, guys? Good to be back. I had quite the Canadian adventure recently, and I think we'll talk about that in a moment. But before we do, Terry, have you been digging around in the internet?
Just a short one. What's happening this Sunday, people?
A Mother's Day? Come on.
Mother's Day.
You know what? That's hey, right. I got to give out a shout out to my mama, Judy.
Yeah.
My mom, I got her. You know what I got her this year for Mother's Day, Terry? Steve?
No.
No, what did you get? Do we want to know?
I got my mom two things that she loves. I gave it to her already last week.
Yeah.
I gave her candy. My mom is in love with candy, and I am as well. I've clearly inherited that from her. Thank you, Mom. And the other one is dogs. I got her a puppy.
Oh, really?
Mama Steiger loves dogs. She's
wow.
One of those. You know, like in The Simpsons when you see the crazy cat lady?
Yeah.
My mom's the crazy dog lady.
Okay.
with a just a hint of cats along with it, just for good measure.
Yeah.
My mom now has 4 dogs.
No.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, man.
4 dogs, and I believe
there's no way.
One cat that she actually desired, and one that's just calling her, you know.
Oh man.
Home.
Okay, so Groupon put out a new survey, and it finds that 40% of moms fake the reaction to gifts that they don't like.
My wife apparently hasn't learned that trick.
How can you tell, you ask? He says the survey finds that they say things like, thank you. Aw, I really needed one of these.
That's a classic.
If she says those kind of things, she might be faking it.
You know what? There is some truth to that. You never know for sure if your mom actually likes what you got her, but
right.
My mom liked that dog.
Yeah, that was a good one.
You know, in some ways, I appreciate the Korean culture because of that. Because in Korea, when you receive a gift, traditionally, you don't open it right in front of whoever's giving it. So you kind of put it aside and you open it later. And the idea is that you don't have to show your reaction to whoever's giving it to you.
Oh, my.
So kind of takes away the joy of seeing the reaction. But it also eliminates the possibility of, you know, showing any negative reaction.
So it says here within their surveys, if you're still looking for good ideas, the results from this survey have come up and they said something more sentimental or homemade, a family trip or a simple card also made the list. There you go. We want to help you out.
Or, as you AC know what, a good old phone call.
Good phone call would work too.
Hey, Mom. It's me.
Yeah. So all the people that won't hear this before Mother's Day.
Yeah. Let's hope you got it right.
Yeah, we hope we got it right.
Yeah, love on your mom. So recently I was away, flew off to Ottawa, and that was interesting. You know, Ottawa's a long ways away. Just, have you guys ever had a chance to go to Ottawa?
Yeah.
It's out there. And it's one of those moments that you that reminds you that Canada's big.
Mm-hmm.
And so at any rate, I went out for the National Prayer Breakfast, which was a really interesting time. Had the opportunity, you know, a lot happens during the prayer breakfast. So I had an opportunity to see what IGM is up to. That's International Justice Mission. I was very encouraged by the work that they're doing.
They're a fantastic organization.
They really are. I you know, met a number of judges and lawyers that love Jesus, love justice, and particularly they were showcasing some of the work that they've been doing in Bolivia. You know, a lot of people know them for going in and prosecuting crimes in other countries, from sex trafficking to slavery and everything in between. But one of the things they don't know is that, for example, IGM also comes along legal systems like in Bolivia and helps them to revamp and to help them to be more efficient in prosecuting.
That's right.
So yeah. great work. At any rate, another thing that was there to do, and I think it's just good for our listeners to know is out there, is CARDIS. CARDIS is a Christian think tank. And in fact, they just launched, I was there for the launch of their Religious Freedom Institute. So that has just launched. You're going to be seeing lots more coming from CARDIS with regards to that. And truth be told, there's a need for that with what's going on. And, you know, it wasn't by accident that at the prayer breakfast this year, they asked Oz Guinness to speak.
Oh, I was so jealous. Just seeing the picture that you posted on Facebook and there's Oz Guinness speaking. I'm like, you dog.
It was so good. So good. And had a chance to talk with Oz and hear what he's up to in his new book that's coming out. But I was so thankful that they had him speak because he talked on the topic of freedom. And he made some very important points. And it was so good because sitting on his left was our Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. And sitting on his right was not only two other legal parties in Canada, the Conservative Party and the New Democratic Party, but the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada.
Richard Wagner?
Yeah, Richard Wagner. Mm, now, wow. Now, if you know anything what's going on in Canada, this is significant. Because, I mean, with Justin Trudeau and the stuff that he's been doing with regards to summer job grants and really challenging religious freedom on that front, and then you've got the Trinity Western case sitting before the Supreme Court, in which we are expecting a ruling, you know, any week now, which, by the way, Bob Kuhn, the president of Trinity Western, was there. You can get a sense for the significance of what's going on in our government right now in the issues surrounding not just freedom. And this is one of the things, by the way, that Oz Guinness said that I thought was very important. He said the greatest challenge to freedom is freedom. There's a lot of truth to that. I mean, it's an irony, right? This paradox that here we've got freedom, and yet it's our freedom and the way we're using that freedom that's going to be the greatest challenge to that freedom. Mm. And in particular, he was challenging those there with what they're going to use that freedom to do with regards to religious freedom. And this really circled back on itself because the argument that he was making is that history shows that once you lose sight of religious freedom, you will lose sight of freedom completely. If you lose your religious freedom, freedom will soon be lost.
Yeah, I think that's so critical to understand, right? Because the reaction that I sometimes see on social media is, what's the big deal? Join us in the 21st century, you religious nut jobs. You know, sometimes I see that kind of a reaction and I go, no, you don't understand. This is a matter of principle. Freedom is being threatened. Freedom that you enjoy, by the way, is linked with religious freedom. Like if you say religious freedom can go, then what stops your freedom, other kinds of freedom that you enjoy, what stops those things from being taken away? If one kind of freedom can be taken away, why not others, right? So to me, this is a really big deal. And here, you know, especially some, not all atheists, but some atheists are kind of, you know, have this very blasé, kind of very dismissive attitude. And I find that really discouraging.
What was really interesting, just to top this all off, is on my way back from Ottawa, I stopped into Winnipeg. And in Winnipeg is a beautiful museum. It's the Canadian Museum of Human Rights. Apparently, it took a long time to build and about $350 million. I mean, this thing is gorgeous. I had the privilege of touring through this with the president and the senior advisor as well. And I mean, these are two guys that have done their PhD work with regards to human rights in different areas. And tour through there with them and talking about my own PhD work with them and getting insights. But one of the things that really hit me is both of these guys understood the significance of what's happening in our culture today with regards to this issue of religious freedom and how important it is. So that was actually part of the conversation that we had as well. And one of the things that really hit me was we were touring through the museum and we went through the Holocaust exhibit. And one of the things that one of the guys brought up was this, is he said it was 6 years before they started gassing the Jews. You know, one of the things that they stripped the Jews of? They stripped them the ability to have universities, to teach. And it was only 6 years later that they started gassing them. I just immediately thought about what is going on with the Trinity Western case. I mean, as soon as the religious freedom was stripped from the Jews, it was 6 years later that they began to gas them. And so it really just brought home the significance of this issue. And one of the other things that Oz talked about, and I think this is important for our politicians and our country to hear, is this idea that freedom is most clearly communicated and built off of the Christian worldview. That is, what, you know, our nation built its religious freedoms from, or freedom from. You see, this is coming from the Christian worldview. This has historically been the case. And we can't lose sight of that.
Some listeners might kind of react to what you're saying, Andy, saying, you know, are you seriously comparing this to the Holocaust? You know, are you seriously saying that if, for example, Trinity Western loses this court case, that we're going to start gassing Christians? You know, how would you respond to that?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Steve, because I'm definitely not an alarmist in that regard in saying, okay, you know, if this court case, you know, doesn't go through, it 6 years later till we're all getting gassed. No, definitely not saying that. But what I am absolutely saying is that depending upon what happens in this court case, this isn't going to be the end. If Trinity loses this court case, this is only going to expand. The loss of religious freedom is only going to expand, and I am happy to argue that it will expand rapidly in this country. As soon as we lose that foundation, that footing, as soon as we start eroding it, I think it's going to erode quite quickly. We want to get into our article, but before we do, I just want to make one more comment that I thought was very fascinating from the prayer breakfast that caught my attention. And that is, one, I was very encouraged by the number of politicians that we have in Canada that unashamedly are Christian and stand up for their faith. That was phenomenal. In particular, I saw MPs, one MP named Bob that's from Prince George. He was one that was putting on the prayer breakfast. Bob Zimmer, I believe it is. Any rate, in front of everybody, right? Prime Minister, everybody there, just unashamedly about Jesus Christ and who Jesus is and him being a Christian. I thought this was very fascinating, how the freedom that our politicians have to be Christians and to do that. On the one hand, hey, I just want to encourage our listeners and young people, if you're in university, please go into politics. Mm-hmm. But then the second thing is, it's interesting that that is not a freedom that's afforded in other institutions. For example, you would never see a professor be able to stand up and say the sorts of things that I heard being said, or teachers as well. I saw a level of religious freedom in our politics that I am not seeing in our school system, for example. Or I wonder if it even exists in our workplace, that I can unashamedly be a Christian.
I guess, as for the university, I mean, technically you are free to do that. I mean, there's nothing stopping you from it. I think a lot of the times the concern is the kind of blacklisting that might happen, right? Where you are ostracized socially. I mean, that sort of thing can happen. Well,
My thing is I've just spent a lot of time in the university and amongst that, and I've never seen anybody speak as openly as I was witnessing in Ottawa, yeah. You know? And so I was like, what's going on there? Why is there a level of religious freedom amongst our politicians that we are not seeing in our school systems?
I guess also we should be careful to distinguish between religious freedom per se and the freedom to express it, because I would assume that some people
I think that's a fair distinction.
Yeah, I think some people might think, you know, religious freedom is a more of a like you can believe what you want kind of thing. When it comes to actually expressing it, it might come with some other costs, maybe things that are not even necessarily legal. So like I was saying earlier, like if a professor were to come out freely saying, hey, I'm a Christian, I am all for Jesus Christ, maybe his credibility might get shot or something like that, even though that's not necessarily the case, right? Where he is so unduly biased just because he's a Christian or a Muslim or whatever else it may be, or an atheist.
So just to add on to this, though, it was interesting that you had the prime minister read a prayer. He was supposed to read a scripture, but he read a prayer and said, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But the New Democratic Party and the Conservative Party both stood up and opened the Bible, read scripture.
Wow.
Right, at this prayer breakfast, right? And again, I'm just going, you know, this is interesting. There is a respect going on here that I just don't see elsewhere in the public square.
It seemed like a very big audience. So it was opened up to all members of Parliament?
Yeah, it was open up to everyone.
Okay.
And I don't know how many hundreds were there, but yeah. It was a sold-out crowd, that's for sure.
Wow.
Hey, well, we got something else that we wanted to chat about here.
Yeah, this was an interesting week in news, especially with Google. Google came out with a new system called Duplex. This system is made to help you make phone calls to people. That doesn't sound too bad in itself. What was really kind of shocking for people was how natural the voice was that came from this system. So they actually did a call to a hairdresser, and they played it at this conference. That person that answered the phone could not even recognize that it was a
computer. Let's play that.
Computer. Yeah.
Let's play both. There's two here. Let's play one. They're going to make a phone call to a hairdresser.
Right.
And then let's play the other one as well, where they make a phone call to a restaurant.
It sounded like a Chinese restaurant. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's play those now.
How can I help you?
Hi, I'm calling to book a women's haircut for a client. I'm looking for something on May 3rd.
Sure, give me 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, what time are you looking for around?
At 12 p.m.
We do not have a 12 p.m. available. The closest we have to that is a 1:15.
Do you have anything between 10 a.m. and 12 p.m.?
Depending on what service she would like, what service is she looking for?
Just a woman's haircut for now.
Okay, we have a 10 o'clock.
10 a.m. is fine.
Okay, what's her first name?
The first name is Lisa.
Okay, perfect. So I will see Lisa at 10 o'clock on May 3rd.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Great. Have a great day. Bye.
That was a real call you just heard. The amazing thing is the assistant can actually understand the nuances of conversation. We've been working on this technology for many years. It's called Google Duplex. It brings together all our investments over the years in natural language understanding, deep learning, text-to-speech. By the way, when we are done, the assistant can give you a confirmation notification saying your appointment has been taken care of. Let me give you another example. Let's say you want to call a restaurant, but maybe it's a small restaurant which is not easily available to book online. The call actually goes a bit differently than expected. So take a listen.
See, how may I help you?
Hi, I'd like to reserve a table for Wednesday the 7th.
For 7 people?
It's for 4 people.
For people, when?
Next Wednesday at 6 p.m.
Oh, actually, we reserve for up to 5 people. For people, you can come.
How long is the wait usually to be seated?
For when, tomorrow or weekday or?
For next Wednesday, the 7th.
Oh no, it's not too busy. You can come for 4 people, okay?
Oh, I gotcha. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Okay, you heard those two conversations, and you could hear that there was no recognition of an AI calling them.
You can tell people are kind of laughing, right, when a duplex calls the hairdresser, and there's the mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, like, and there's like all these like pause fillers. Like stuff that we normally do in our kind of a natural day-to-day conversation, like it's all worked into that. It sounds pretty natural.
I was eating breakfast when I came across this article and listened to that. And I can tell you right now that I was mid-sipping my coffee. You know, I got a spoon of oatmeal mid-air and is just kind of mouth open going, oh, what? Wow.
Yeah.
That's realistic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it was almost, you know, borderline disturbing, actually. And then I began to read up on it because I got to tell you guys, I have a pet peeve, okay? And I'm just going to come out and just say that I have a buddy. His name's Brian. He's actually a good friend. And Brian knows this, that he drives me crazy because Brian is into every newest craze. And like as soon as he'll watch something like this, he'll call me and be like, well, now computers can talk as perfectly as people can. And so that just drives me crazy, though, whenever you get this idea of promoting the technology beyond its capabilities, you know? And I have to admit, as soon as I watched this, I was like, oh my goodness, they have totally, you know, broke through the AI barrier of, you know, making the ability to convince you.
Yeah, I was immediately thinking of the Turing test.
Yeah, so was I. That was immediately where I was going. And so then I started rummaging through more articles because I'm like, mercy, if they can do it that well, they easily can pass the Turing test with that. Because clearly in that circumstance, they did pass the Turing test. These people, with regards to the restaurant or with regards to the haircut, they were unaware that they were talking with a machine. Now, the thing is, as you begin to dig deeper and you look into Google's articles that they've written, they can only do this. So this is where we bring it back down to planet Earth, okay? What's actually going on here? These conversations can only happen in what's called a closed domain. In other words, there needs to be strict limits on what the context of the conversation is. And within those strict limits, they can make it sound very impressive. Now, to Google's credit, I will say, A, the voice sounds very real, which makes me wonder, was it a person to begin with? But needless to say, that's very real. And the pauses, the way that the pauses are done and the way that the language is done is very natural and comes across very real. So I got to give it to them with that.
Yeah, there are certain things that we do in our kind of a natural day-to-day conversations, like, for example, if you listen to the second conversation carefully, there, Duplex actually elaborates, right? He says, you know, Friday next week, and then he adds the 18th. You know, that's the sort of thing that we do, and I think, again, to Google's credit, they've done a fabulous job making it sound really natural, picking up on these speech patterns.
Now, on the restaurant, you could tell that it was hard to understand this lady with a Chinese accent, which was a great illustration of, you know, its ability to understand difficult language. And now, one of the things, though, that Google talks about is that they have these tricks to bring conversations back on track where the machine, if you will, at times didn't understand the conversation, but was able to trick you with some ploys that we even use, where they will restate what was previously said to get another chance at it, or to communicate more clearly by saying it in another way. And so, you know, Google kind of tipped its hat that there are some tricks that they are employing to be able to do this. Needless to say, it's convincing.
They're still saying it's not a working product yet.
It's an experiment.
It's an experiment, and it was pre-recorded. So,
well, it gets back to these closed domains, right? There were strict parameters. This
right.
is a conversation only
yeah.
about getting a reservation for a haircut,
right.
you know, within very strict parameters. Now, the question, though, that we always have to ask, though, is it worked in very strict parameters, but it worked. Yeah. It's only a matter of time that they get good at lots of strict parameters and then combine those together. And this technology can do lots of different applications and is very convincing, which raises some serious ethical questions.
I found it interesting as I was reading this article from The Verge, because they had an interview with Google, or interview as in like they contacted Google for comments and things like that. And the article in The Verge was describing some of the outcry against this kind of technology that can easily trick people. And so, you know, is Google going to make it so that, you know, Duplex is going to always identify itself as an AI as they make the phone call or something like that? But I always found it, I found it interesting throughout the entire article. There was this, it was taken for granted that this is not okay because the person would not be speaking to another person. This is a robot. It's not the real thing.
Yeah, that's a good point, Steve.
There's something intrinsically different between humans and robots, and we recognize it.
Let me make that point for people in a way that I think is helpful, and that is that we define a thing by its purpose. And I've brought this up before, and we don't have time to get into that. But if we use that ontology, then you see with what this Google technology is doing is that it inherently is deceptive. It is a human mimicking machine. It is meant to deceive you into believing that it's a person. Now, in this case, not to do anything sinister, but to be able to quickly have a conversation to set up a hair appointment. But you can quickly understand, though, that this kind of technology that's meant to deceive you could be used for sinister acts and not something like just setting up a hair appointment.
How about, Andy, if Google, let's say, decided to change the purpose of the project and they decided to create a person out of the AI, then would that change the robot into a person?
Well, you would have to define what a person is.
Right.
I mean, you can't just state it's a person. You would have to define, well, what do you mean by a person? And now this is going to get us into some really important metaphysical questions. Because right now, we tend to work off of this idea that if something can mimic something else and do so to a certain degree, then it is that thing. I think about
it's a performance-based view.
Yeah, and I think about even, you know, things like gold, for example. People have wanted to create gold for years, right? If I can combine the right ingredients in the right sorts of ways and I produce something that has the molecular structure of gold, well, then it's gold. And so the same thing is being asked here. Well, if I look at a human being purely from its mechanics, if I look at a human being purely physically, then we have a binary code that's just DNA. Well, we just have a machine that's working. Well, no, DNA is a code that works off of four letters, but the machine is just binary code. It's just working off of two numbers, right? And if you can just do the programming right, you know, you got DNA programming on the one hand and you got the digital coding on the other. Well, really, it's just a matter of getting one coding to mimic the other kind of coding. So that's where your worldview becomes so significant when we're asking questions like what a person is. Whereas a Christian's going to define a person is that which is made with the purpose of being in relationship with God and each other. And then adding on to that, this idea that we were made in the image of God so that we can have that sort of relationship. Well, that's not something that you can code. But yet, depending upon what you're starting your worldview from, is going to depend upon, you know, and how you're defining person, whether or not you can create a person or not. Does that make sense? Would you push back on that in any way, Steve?
Yeah, I think you're right. One thought that I had, though, was I was thinking you said earlier that something is what it is by the virtue of the purpose that it was made for.
Well, I could be more specific, and I just didn't want to go too far down this rabbit trail. But to be more specific, I'm making a distinction between the parts that something is made of and the purposeful whole that something is made for.
That's right. So then I was thinking, okay, if Google decided to make it make a person out of this, then does it make it into a person? And you say it has to. You first have to define what a person is. I'm just wondering, how do you get to that definition of what a person is? Because then you would have to, again, judge by the purpose, the thing that it's made for.
Well, here for Google, what they're going to do is they're going to follow a Turing test model where they're going to just say, well, a person is what you are. So what I'm going to do then is instead of having to define what a person is, I'm just going to create a machine that pretends to be you, that behaves in a way that you can't distinguish between you and the machine. Thus, it's a person.
Right. So then you would have to work from the worldview and then ask what a person is. And then from there, you look at, so that would set the frame for what this duplex system or whatever this AI that Google is creating, whatever it is, right? So
right. And they're not going to do that. So instead, what they've got is just a human or a person mimicking machine according to its purpose.
Okay. That makes sense to me.
I mean, we have to recognize that Google did recognize this outcry from the people. And they, in their one of their statements, they said that they're designing a feature to disclose this built-in voice, right?
Yeah, and to their credit, they are showing their work.
That's right.
Because they want to, I think what they want is to start a conversation.
Yeah.
And I want to push back on this, though, because, you know, I think one of the misnomers that's been going on for some time is that the legal system has the responsibility to catch up with people like Google and others. And what this outcry was really telling me that I was seeing quite clearly is, no, Google, you have the ethical responsibility to think about the ramifications of the technology you're creating and to preemptively do something instead of waiting for the legal system to catch up with you and to begin to put parameters around the work that you're doing.
Yeah, I think maybe what Google is aiming at, though, is for us to have a conversation, not necessarily in legal terms, but for example, one of the things that they talked about is, so how are they going to make Duplex disclose itself? Because if it just says, hi, this is Duplex, you know, I'm making a phone call or whatever to book a hair appointment, the other person might just hang up and that might be a problem. So then what Google said was, well, we kind of want our society to organically evolve around this issue, right? So some kind of etiquette might evolve around this organically. Now, that doesn't do things preemptively, like you said, and I think Google does have some responsibility to preemptively think about this to minimize whatever damage that might result. But at the same time, I'm a little sympathetic to Google in the sense that, yeah, I guess you kind of do have to do it by trial and error to an extent, right? Just as some game developers, they'll have things like closed beta, open beta. They let the players play it out to work out the kinks. So I think that's what Google is trying to do.
The only problem here, though, is that we are dealing with something that's dangerous. And I think that changes the way that we go about this. Now, for example, somebody online brought up, I can't remember who it was, brought up the example of natural gas. Now, natural gas companies have worked hard to make, or I guess natural gas naturally is odorless. It has no smell, right? So it's convincing you that it's oxygen. Let's just put it in those terms. So then the natural gas company realizes that they have a moral responsibility to put an odor to natural gas so that you realize when you're dealing with natural gas and that you, in fact, are not dealing with oxygen, which I think is an interesting example because it's just demonstrating the fact that, listen, it's dangerous, right? And so there needs to be something that is helping with that challenge. Now, let's just think about this for a moment. With regards to the dangers of this sort of technology. And I think that we can't be naive. You know, it's that whole utopia versus dystopia distinction. There's a lot of people that think, oh, listen, technology's great. It's going to lead us to a utopia. But there's a lot of people and a lot of shows on right now. They're like, well, people aren't as great as you think that they are, right? What are people going to do with this kind of technology? Now, I've thought about a number of things that people can do with this kind of technology. For example, they could pretend to be your bank. Another thing that they could do is it could be a hoax. It could call you and say whatever it wants to say. Or what if this technology evolved to the point where they were able to mimic people's voices, like your mom's voice, for example, and was able to call kids, right? Or call your school with that mom, with that voice. It just goes on from there. I think you can begin to see how diabolical that kind of technology could be if you're not careful.
Yeah, and there are all kinds of other kind of social issues that could come from that too. For example, I mean, you've seen how social media, ironically enough, disconnects people from each other, right? And in the sense that,
right.
For example, you know, some people find sending Facebook messages or texting much more preferable to talking to a person, like a, you know, have an actual face-to-face conversation. In the same way, this is yet another thing that disconnects us from real human interaction. It's a robot that's calling a person. So yes, it comes with certain kind of convenience, but what other impact is it going to have? Because just as with Facebook and things like that, we thought, well, great, you know, we can keep in touch with the ones that we love, but it had this whole side effect of, for example, teens getting depressed because they're seeing all this news around the world, all the horrible things that are happening. And you know, there's more and more isolation between people that's happening, all that kind of stuff.
It really brings up the question of social value. Mm-hmm. And what is going to be the effect of that? And Steve, just to tag on to that, one of the things I was thinking was, what do people tend to do? And what does technology tend to lend to? Well, it tends to do the kind of things that we don't want to do, right? That's often what motivates us to create these sorts of technologies. And I was thinking, well, what are some of the things that we don't like to do? Well, I don't like to fire people, for example. So what if I was able to use this kind of technology to call up those that it's time to can them, right? Or I was thinking, I don't like calling my school either. I don't necessarily like going to, you know, to talk to certain people, right? Or maybe my kid's in trouble.
Or and if you want to call up potential speakers for the Apologetics Canada conference, you know, it can be a little uncomfortable, you know, especially when you're making cold contact.
Oh, yeah. Or what if I want to break up with my girlfriend?
Wow.
Right? Or what if, well, here's one that I think is a reality that could really be reality. What if I don't want to have to do 50 interviews?
Right.
I want to just add one thing on here. Well, actually, I'm just going to add two things here. One is, I think there's some positive stuff with regards to this. One of the things I love a lot about Google is being able to go and see when stores are opening and closing. And one of the big things they talk about using this technology to do is to contact stores and to make sure they've got their times right, especially during holidays, which I think is great. I just want to throw one other thing in there that I find fascinating. And that is that it goes both ways. So not only when the machine is tricking the person, but what happens when the machine actually didn't trick the person? And the sorts of issues that could be caused there. Now think about this. Humans have an incredible ability to detect abnormalities in conversations. We're experts at doing it. We're experts at detecting personhood. And there's obvious reasons why we're very good at doing that. Søren Kierkegaard creates a very interesting thought experiment of the crazy guy. I don't know if you remember this one, but there is an inmate and he escapes from prison. He knows he's crazy and he realizes the police are after him and he realizes he's got to do something so that he doesn't get caught. And so he decides that anytime anybody asks him any questions, he's just going to say the truth. And so a police officer comes, starts talking to him, and he begins to tell the police officer that it's a beautiful day. And the police officer says, yeah, it is a beautiful day. And then the crazy guy looks on the ground and sees that there's a crack on the ground. He goes, you know, there's a crack on the ground. And the police officer goes, yeah, I know. There's a crack on the ground. He says all these different things, and they're all true things. But quite quickly, the police officer realizes, I got my crazy guy. And I think about technology that is not disclosing itself as a robot or whatever, as it's having a conversation. And what happens when those conversations go astray and things don't match up quite accurately? And now all of a sudden that person is on guard because they don't realize what sort of person they're talking to all of a sudden on the other line. Am I talking to a crazy person? Because their answers haven't matched up quite right. And now I'm not sure that I want to make this appointment with this individual. Are you tracking with me? See, because on that Google thing, we were watching perfect conversations. But what happens when those conversations don't go quite perfectly? And now all of a sudden that spidey sense of I'm dealing with something not quite right here. Now what do I do? And what are my obligations to what I think is a person, but is in fact not a person?
Well, I think when you hear the conversations that we're going to play, maybe close your eyes. Because there was a few points in time where I kind of recognized like a robotic voice, right?
It wasn't 100%.
It wasn't 100%, but it, for the most part, 95% of it or more, it was very, very real.
But they're showing you perfect ones where it worked out.
Yeah.
What about the thousands where it didn't work out?
Yeah,
and exactly. What are the moral obligations that this technology has to that person that has now convinced you that something's not right, but they're trying to convince you it's a person. So in some ways it is a hoax that's taking place, and you don't know it. And now you're starting to wonder with regards to this conversation and this appointment that I'm supposed to make, what sorts of obligations do I have to that technology? Do you guys understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I think to take it a step further, I mean, we could flip it too. What if, you know, it's a real person calling, but the person kind of fumbles a few words and now the other person thinks, oh, maybe I'm talking to a machine. Like, I think with this kind of technology, I can easily see just about every phone call being treated with suspicion by default, right? And so you're actually talking to a person, the person fumbles a few words, and I could just tell the person, you know what, just get out of here, let me talk to a real person kind of thing. Right, and that was another issue that this article was bringing up. By the way, we'll put this article up on our show notes, so if you listeners want to check it out, it's going to be there.
All right. I think our time has come to an end today. I think we're a little bit over. But that was a very interesting article and happenstance this week, for sure.
Yeah, lots to talk about there, yeah.
Yeah. We appreciate our listener support, and to those who have left reviews on iTunes, thank you so much. And again, I was looking over a number of the reviews and going back a number of months, and Model Citizen says, great podcast that speaks to issues of today with a uniquely Canadian perspective. T.H. Law says, great discussions on current event topics from a Christian perspective. The discussions are a great primer and introduction to methods of Christian apologetics as well. We appreciate you leaving those reviews. And for those who haven't, go to iTunes and rate us and leave us a review on iTunes. We would really appreciate that, and we'd love to hear from you as well.
In fact, we just heard from a listener in Australia that's told us he's binge listening to,
really?
to the show. And
yeah.
Want to give out a shout to you in Australia.
Nice.
Binge listen away.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us, listeners. The Apologetics Canada podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week for more things to think about. Come on!